Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. High-level meetings all over the world today as foreign leaders absorb the meaning of the election of Donald Trump. On the campaign trail, Trump was dismissive of much of the global status quo, promised to tear up trade deals, to force Mexico to pay for a border wall. He talked down old alliances and talked up Putin's Russia, nuclear weapons. The list is long. If he follows through, it would be a new kind of world order or disorder. The whole world is now watching. This hour On Point, the world and President Trump. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What kind of profile in the world do you expect of President Donald Trump? Do you expect him to follow through on campaign promises? Do you welcome that? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was President-elect Trump in yesterday's victory speech, laying out his view of dealing with the rest of the world.
I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, all people and all other nations. We will seek common ground, not hostility, partnership, not conflict.
Common ground, not hostility, partnership, but on the campaign trail, he could be fiery. Here he was at a campaign rally in Fort Wayne, Indiana in May.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
What will it be for Trump foreign policy? Joining us now from London is Zanya Wicket, head of the U.S. and the Americas program and dean of the Queen Elizabeth II Academy for Leadership and International Affairs at the British think tank Chatham House. She's a dual national, British and American, former director for South Asia at the National Security Council in Washington under President George W. Bush, formerly at the U.S. State Department. Zanya Wicket, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
From Washington, we're joined by Ambassador John Herbst, retired from the State Department with the rank of career minister after 3 decades in the business, is now director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. He's been ambassador to Ukraine and Uzbekistan, held diplomatic posts in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Russia. Bears noting that he was one of 75 retired career diplomats who signed a letter in September calling Donald Trump entirely unqualified to serve as president and commander-in-chief. Ambassador Herbst, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And finally, we're joined by Iswar Prasad in Ithaca, New York, professor of trade policy at Cornell University and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, former head of the IMF's China division, author of Gaining Currency, The Rise of the Renminbi. Iswar Prasad, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be on your show.
Zanya, may I come to you first in London for a sense of how the UK and beyond the UK, Europe, is receiving the news of Donald Trump's election as president?
There's huge uncertainty and some fear. The fear, in large part, comes about because of the uncertainty. So, as you played earlier, Donald Trump has said all sorts of things in the campaign, and I think most people don't expect him to implement many of those things. Most expect him not to want to implement most of those things, as most candidates do. They say one thing in the primaries, they say another thing in the election campaign, and they govern a third way. But there is trepidation, there is fear, and a lot of that comes about because there's real uncertainty about what a Donald Trump presidency will look like. Will he follow through on his promises, his pledges to essentially step back from NATO? Is the love fest, if you will, that he appears to have with President Putin real? What will happen to in the environmental agenda in the U.S.? What will happen to the trade agenda in the U.S.? So there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of concern because many Europeans did actually approve of the Obama agenda, the Obama foreign policy, and it looks like that's going to change quite quickly.
John Herbst, Ambassador Herbst, is it wishful thinking to imagine that Donald Trump will not act on foreign policy campaign promises once he's in the White House?
I think he'll have a political need to act in some way on trade, perhaps also on climate change. It's less clear on other, and also perhaps something relating to our trade relationship with China. On other issues, I'm not sure it's quite so clear.
When you say act on climate change, I guess in this case you mean act to, what, step back from the obligations of the Paris Accords that the U.S. is party to?
That's what he said. I don't know what precisely he would do. He'd have to measure, you might say, political considerations here against international risk, but some step in the area that he addressed during the campaign. He'd not be as radical as the things he actually said.
We'll look at that. Ishwar Prasad on trade. This is your wheelhouse. He's made big promises to tear up, renegotiate trade deals. Simple question first. Can that be done? Can he do it?
Well, in principle, he can do two things. First is take off the table a number of trade deals that the U.S. is in the process of negotiating, such as the TPP, which President Obama has negotiated with the other countries, but which have not yet been ratified by Congress. I think the chances of the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the trade agreement with Europe ever getting through are extremely slim right now. But what he can also do is call into question existing trade relationships. Now, whether he will do something as drastic as pulling back from NAFTA, the trade deal with Mexico and Canada, is an open question. But certainly a Trump president with the backing of Congress has in its power to do it. The risk is that even if he doesn't do it, the concern that there might be a pullback from those trade relationships in some unilateral fashion creates a lot of uncertainty for businesses, both U.S. businesses, but also businesses operating on other sides of the border. And that uncertainty is something that is going to hurt the U.S. economy and the economies of our partner countries. But we'll have to wait and see whether he really follows through. But certainly the temptation to do something on trade, because it could be the easiest political win, as the ambassador alluded to, I think is a real risk here.
I want to come back and look at trade, but Xenia in London, if I may, Xenia Wickett, I want to pull the lens back a little further. I'm looking at the Financial Times today. They're writing about Trump's victory. They say marks a thunderous reputation of the status quo. Okay, the status quo is not all perfect, and many American voters might want to see some reputation there. But they go on to say Trump's victory represents at face value a threat to the Western democratic model. You didn't write it, but interpret for us what they're maybe pointing to there, Xenia.
I think they're pointing to something important, and I didn't write it, but I have. And it picks up something that Eswar just said. What he does matters. The perception of what he's going to do also matters. So the fact that he may not cancel NAFTA, that he may not pull out of NATO is important, clearly very, very important. But actually the perception that he might do those things creates huge uncertainty, and it creates a sense of where the world is going and where America is going that is very, very uncomfortable for America's allies and may cause America's potential foes to take actions in response to that, even though Trump may not do something so extreme. So I think perception is extraordinarily important. That's also true of the Western democratic model, to your question in particular, Tom, which is there's a real perception internationally that when foreigners have looked, when the international community has looked at the election over the last year or so, and the tenor of the debate, the rhetoric, Donald Trump's promises to jail Clinton, those kind of statements, there are many people who've looked at it and said, if that's what democracy is, we don't want it. We don't need that kind of democracy. The idea, this shining, sitting on a hill that has been the United States, the appeal of American democracy has been tarnished quite considerably by this election, by the racist comments that Donald Trump has made in the past, that the sexist comments that he's made in the past. And so there is a strong sense that there's a threat to the Western democratic model. The other part of it, of course, is if you think of the two poles of the Western model, that's the United States and Europe, Europe is thoroughly transfixed by Brexit, by holding the European Union together. So it's not leading this the West, as it were. And with a Trump presidency, there's every sense that Trump doesn't want to lead the West either, or maybe can't lead the West. And so the question arises of there being no leader to the West anymore. And therefore, what are the consequences of that? Well, the consequences are, of course, that other countries with other ideologies like China and Russia will fill the gap. And there's a great fear of that.
We saw applause, John Herbst, in the lower house of the Russian parliament, the Russian Duma. We've read from at news of Trump's victory. We've read from China in the state-run news agency there, the sort of chortling about this outcome. They wrote, probably the most divisive and scandalous election in American history has eroded voters' faith in the two-party system, as many voters called it a game of money, power, and influence. Who's moaning and who's celebrating today with Donald Trump's election, Ambassador?
Well, I think we've already heard that many leaders in Europe, many of our allies, are deeply concerned. I think it's clear that the Russians consider Trump's victory a win. In fact, you know, it's been clear from watching the Russian media for months, or even from conversations I've had with quasi-official Russians, by which I mean think tankers from Moscow, that they wanted, that Trump was their guy. They wanted him to win. And you had an extraordinary statement by Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, saying, quote, the following: "Obviously, we know people from his entourage, Trump's entourage, quote, quite a few have been staying in touch with Russian representatives."
Through the campaign, he's saying.
Yes, that's quite an extraordinary statement, and actually a little bit embarrassing for the president-elect's team, since they denied any such contacts. So Moscow is clearly hoping that Trump will not care that much about Russian aggression in Ukraine and Russian threats against the Baltic members of NATO. We don't know if this will actually be what Trump's policies reflect, but certainly Moscow is hoping for that.
Ishwar, many American voters, though, have gone with Donald Trump and responded to his overall, his characterization is that the U.S. has kind of been screwed in the global world order. Fair?
You know, I think, Tom, that this is a shrill and piercing cry from workers in particular who felt excluded from the benefits of globalization. And we're going to have to respond to this in some fashion or the other. The big question is whether Mr. Trump's policies are the right ones to address those difficult issues. So we'll have to wait and see whether he puts into place the big reforms that could improve American productivity or just turn back to taunting allies, which is the risk.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world and President-elect Donald Trump, from trade to ISIS to NATO, China and the wall, how the world sees Donald Trump, how Donald Trump may see turn the world. You can join us this hour. If Trump follows through on every campaign vow statement, what kind of world will we see? And do you want the full Trump package, the wall, pay-to-play allies, a trade turnaround, bomb the hell out of ISIS? Do you expect him to tone it down in office or to get provoked, act, lash out? Zinnia Wickett is with us from Chatham House in the U.K., British and U.K. U.S. citizen, was on the National Security Council here in George W. Bush's White House. Ambassador John Herbst is with us, has served all over now at the Atlantic Council in Washington. Ishwar Prasad from Cornell University is with us, author of Gaining Currency, The Rise of the Renminbi, the Chinese Currency. Lots of reaction over the last couple of days to the election of President-elect Trump. Here's Vladimir Putin congratulating Trump yesterday. Ready for warmer ties with the U.S., he said.
And I'd also like to congratulate Mr. Donald Trump with his victory in these elections.
Но Россия готова и хочет восстановления полноформатных отношений с Соединенными Штатами.
But Russia is ready and wants to restore the full-fledged relations with the United States.
Big smiles from Russia. In France, French President François Hollande congratulated Trump, but said his election had introduced a period of uncertainty.
Les États-Unis constituent un partenaire de tout premier plan.
Saying here, the U.S. represents a priority partner for France, and what is at stake now is peace, the fight against terrorism, the situation in the Middle East, economic relations, and the preservation of the planet. That's quite a list of what is now at stake in the French president's view. And here's Nigel Farage, former leader of the UK Independent Party, key player in the Brexit movement in the UK, welcoming Trump's victory, said he was not surprised, called it a victory for the little guy.
2016 is, by the looks of it, going to be the year of two great political revolutions. I thought Brexit was big, but boy, this looks like it's going to be even bigger.
Ambassador Herbst, can we go to a sort of structure of assessment of how this unfolds? How will you watch as Trump foreign policy begins to manifest itself? How will you look at it?
Well, first you have to start with his team. We don't know yet who will be his Secretary of State, who will be his National Security Advisor, who will be his Secretary of Defense. There are names that are starting to float.
Newt Gingrich, the Secretary of State, has come out. Jeff Sessions of Alabama's potential defense secretary.
That's correct. And Senator Corker of Tennessee as another potential Secretary of State. And, of course, you have Vice President Mike Pence. Now, Mike Pence's view fit very comfortably within the conservative mainstream, the pre-Trump conservative mainstream. I would say the same about Corker, a little bit less about Sessions, but still there. Also about Gingrich. Now, if these gentlemen take these positions, we have to assume that Trump's foreign policy will look less like an extrapolation of his campaign statements and more like what we've seen in years past, albeit with some differences, especially, as I said before, in the trade area and maybe as well on immigration.
How would a Trump foreign policy fit with guys who have sort of been neocons, ready to use American force abroad? Donald Trump has said no thank you to that on the campaign trail, by and large, though there's also bomb the hell out of them out there.
Well, you're absolutely right. What Trump advocates in Syria is not the same as the neoconservative position. Trump does not seem to have a particular animus against President Assad, for example, and that's something which could make him cooperate with Putin. But he does have a strong interest, as he stated, in intervening substantially to destroy ISIS. So there's a certain commonality. Also, Trump has said that he doesn't want to get involved generally in nation building, which neoconservatives have been only too happy to. On the other hand, Trump's policy on Iran comes straight from the neocon playbook.
That is, no thanks to the Iran deal. Is that also a tear-it-up deal for him?
Well, he has said he would cancel it on day one. I don't know if he'll actually do that. But I think President Obama deserves a lot of credit for getting that deal. And President Obama in part got that deal by laying out the choice. Essentially, if you're against Iran acquiring nukes, you have two choices, this deal or war. I would hope that President Trump would not be interested ultimately in war with Iran.
You were critical of Donald Trump during the campaign, but you've also been rather critical of Barack Obama's foreign policy stance, suggesting maybe it's on the reserved, retiring, even weak side. What do you say?
Well, there is a certain very clear similarity between Trump and Obama, and I've spoken about this for months, and that is they both believe, and they're both right about this, that the United States overextended itself in the Middle East over the past 15 years. We had the failed and unnecessary interventions in Iraq and in Libya, and we had an intervention in Afghanistan, which was necessary, but then we had too broad of an ambition for that country, and therefore we've run into failure. And they both share that, and they're both right on that. I've criticized Obama for employing the same logic in Europe, in the crisis of fighting Russian revisionism, Russian aggression in Georgia and Ukraine, and his provocations in the Baltic states. And Obama's not been sufficiently strong. Trump has seemed to be uncomprehending of the problem of Russian revisionism. Although, again, the people around him, again, Gingrich, Corker, Sessions, especially Pence, all understand this very well.
Zinya Wickett in London, think with us for a minute about NATO and Russia. If Donald Trump presents a warmer face to Moscow, if he's less critical of its interventions, Crimea, Ukraine, beyond, is that a green light to Russia for a more forward, invasive kind of profile? And what about Trump's assertion that it's a sort of pay-to-play notion with NATO, that if they don't pay up, take more of the burden, the U.S. could just be out of there? How does that play out?
I think European capitals have to sit up very straight. We there is great concern here in Europe that Donald Trump will pull back from NATO, will delegitimize NATO. But you have to remember that the last four defense secretaries have been telling Europeans that they need to step up more in NATO, that they need to bear more burdens, they need to put more resources into NATO. So in some respects, I mean, you can see this as a fundamental transition away from the Obama administration's policy towards NATO. You can also see it as just an extension of what America has been trying to get NATO member states to do for many years now, which is to say, guys, we're no longer going to be funding approximately 75% of NATO expenses, that others have to step up. And so in some respects, is Donald Trump going to walk away from NATO? No, I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that he would do that. Is Donald Trump going to expect European states to bear more burdens? Absolutely, and that's something that the American government has been trying to do for many, many years. So I think that it is very easy to take Donald Trump's kind of extreme rhetoric during the debate and take it as truth. I suspect it was rhetoric, it was simplified, it was very powerful politically, but you have to understand the nuance of it. And this isn't so different from what defense secretaries and the U.S. government more broadly has been trying to get Europe to do for some while. So I think you have to temper the extreme rhetoric with a certain broader history, perhaps, is the way to put it. But there is going to be an expectation that if Europe doesn't step up, then they shouldn't expect America to fill that gap every time.
We'll see how tempered it is. Ambassador Herbst, what about Moscow in this equation? Will it be inclined to have warmer relations and not push its influence because Donald Trump shows a friendlier face? Or is that an invitation to more forward-leaning Russian foreign policy, even intervention, Baltics and beyond?
It would be smart for Putin to you know, test the waters with Trump to see if he can make some sort of relationship with him that would make it easier for Putin, for example, to continue his aggression in Ukraine with less cost. I don't know if that would succeed, and I certainly hope it would not. And again, there are many people around Trump who would understand that game and would try to stop it. But Putin has proved himself to be a risk taker. You know, when he went into Syria in a large way in September of 15, people were saying he was going to do that in order to demonstrate his value to the West in Syria so that the West would lay off him in Ukraine. But instead, he pursued policies in Syria which are anathema in Brussels, in Berlin, in Washington. And in fact, he's made his own position in Europe worse as a result of his intervention in Syria. So I wouldn't rule out that even with President Trump, Putin might not try to steal another march.
Where?
And if that were to happen, where? Well, it could be by a provocation in the Baltic states. It could be by a further aggression in Ukraine beyond the low-grinding war that they're currently conducting. It could be by something more in Syria. A major attack, for example, on the relatively weak opposition forces that we support. And by doing that, he could embarrass Trump and then, you know, find a reaction which, from my stance, would be only good to establish a strong American policy vis-a-vis Russian aggression.
It's the whole spectrum here, from security to trade, economies. Zinya, Ambassador John Herbst, Ishwa, please stand by. David's calling from Greenville, South Carolina. Lots of callers here. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to point out there seems to be a lot of anxiety and fear going around. And, you know, a good place to look at it is when Trump was elected, they said the futures for the Dow were down 800. Well, we had a surging day yesterday. So I think there's a lot of this abject fear mongering going around, and people kind of need to pump the brakes. You know, in regards to every policy positions Trump had on his campaign, you know, name one politician that fulfilled every single policy promise they made during a campaign. You know, I think Obama's still trying to close Guantanamo Bay, right? So the way I look at it is, I think there's going to be some, he's going to slow it down a little bit when he gets into office. But, you know, what happened here was is that you had a divergence from the two political party system, right?
Yes.
It wasn't an election about a Republican or a Democrat. This was a revolt against the people that were running our institutions and our country.
And in global terms, what was it a revolt against, David? In global terms?
You know, in global terms, I think, you know, you look at the Brexit. I mean, again, another revolt against the elites. I think you're seeing this take place in a large scale throughout the world. And I think the U.S. was just another domino in that.
Why do you think it's happening, David?
You know, I think people have become disaffected with the way their governments and their institutions are run. And I think people have kind of, you know, gotten complacent. And now that period of time is over. And you're seeing people really start to become more aware of what the people are doing that are running our country. And the folks want more of a say in that.
David, I appreciate your call. Ishwar Prasad, there's the widespread feeling, clearly, in the vote in the U.S. that the sort of neoliberal globalist order has not worked out for a lot of people, middle class and below in particular. And do you see a legitimate backlash here in the Trump victory? How do you see it playing out, Ishwar?
There is certainly a strong sense of disaffection, and clearly it was prevalent in a very large portion of the U.S. electorate, Tom. The question now is what sort of policies are going to help those who are disaffected? And certainly the notion of getting tough against the U.S.'s trading partners and trying to put in place some reforms that sweep out the political stasis that we see in Washington, D.C., that clearly resonated very well. Now, there are a number of checks and balances in terms of what Mr. Trump can do. And as his caller properly alluded to, I think Mr. Trump may not follow through on all of his extreme positions. But that still leaves open the question of what he is going to do in terms of delivering. Now, many of the things that he's spoken about, improving infrastructure, trying to reform the tax system, if done the right way, and so on, can actually really improve American competitiveness if done the right way. But those are all very difficult things to do, even when the same party controls both houses of Congress, because there are competing interests here. And I think, again, the political view among a good part of the electorate is that invariably the political and economic elite get their way. So if Mr. Trump can actually change that, that will certainly help. But the risk here, again, is that he goes for the somewhat easier wins. He has taken China to task for its currency and trade policies, and the other reforms that are necessary to improve productivity, to deal with the disruption that many workers in the labor force face, which is due not just to trade, but also to technological factors and so on. But rather than fixing those fundamental things, it's a lot easier to be tough on China. And that could evoke a very strident response from China, which could start escalating into a much bigger trade war.
What might that look like, Ishwar? What might that look like, in fact?
So let's say Mr. Trump were to label China a currency manipulator, which actually is against the facts, because China has been trying to prevent its currency from depreciating over the last 2 years and is actually doing the U.S. a favor. Or if he were to raise tariffs against China, in the short run, that would hurt both the U.S. and Chinese economies, because China would lose access to U.S. markets. It would hurt U.S. consumers because Chinese goods would be more expensive. But it would also affect U.S. businesses that are operating in China. You could have the Chinese government shut off or reduce access to Chinese markets for American manufacturers, make it harder for American manufacturers like Walmart and Apple that are using China as their production basis. And especially given that China has a somewhat autocratic form of government, and over the next year, they're going to go through a political transition. They too need to appear tough. So this could escalate very quickly. And the problem here, again, as Zinnia pointed out, is that the U.S. has been the leader on a variety of issues, like pushing forward the notion of free enterprise being the best form of economic organization, having free trade be a good thing for the world. But all of that is going to be held back if the U.S. retreats into a more isolationist and protectionist stance. And once upon a time, this may not have mattered a great deal, because the U.S. was the dominant economic and political hegemon. But now, as your other guests have pointed out, China and Russia and other countries are standing on the sidelines. China is the second largest economy in the world, and there are many countries already coming into its embrace. If the U.S. pulls back, China is going to increase its influence, and it could be the winner in the long run.
Zinnia, does this bring us back to the big picture here? Could Trump score some trade victories in the short term, but put us in a whole new world when it comes to global leadership and the models of what people imagine the future looks like, democratic versus authoritarian, Chinese style?
I think that we've talked a little bit already about Donald Trump's unpredictability and his his approval of being unpredictable, his attitude that unpredictability is actually a positive, that uncertainty in negotiations...
The art of the deal and all that.
The art of the deal, exactly. The other thing that, that we believe about Donald Trump, and there's some evidence to show is true, based on his commentary as well as his history, is how important being transactional is. It's all about this negotiation. It's all about this deal. Now, for those of us who've worked in the foreign policy sector, relationships take an awful long time to build. Partnerships, alliances take an awful long time to build. And so it's extraordinarily important to think about the consequences of what you're doing over the long term. And I think some of the fear is that Donald Trump would take a short-term attitude to a trade deal without worrying about the long term. Donald Trump, sitting here in London, would have a agreement on a trade deal with the UK, not worrying about the consequences for Europe. And I think that's one of the fears sitting here in Europe, that it's going to be very transactional in the years ahead.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world and President Donald Trump. From trade to ISIS to NATO, China, the wall. How the world sees President-elect Trump, how Donald Trump may see, or even turn, the world. With Iswar Prasad, professor of trade policy at Cornell, author of Gaining Currency, The Rise of the Renminbi, that's the Chinese currency, of course. Ambassador John Herbst is with us, U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, to Uzbekistan, consul general in Jerusalem, served all over, now retired at the Atlantic Council. Zenya Wickett is with us from Chatham House in London, and you can join us as well. What do you see coming globally in the Trump years? Is Trump right that the U.S. has lost standing in the world? Will he regain it? Will Donald Trump carry the torch for American ideals in the world? Can the U.S. be the global power leader without those ideals? Lots of callers here. Jenny in Iowa City. Jenny, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Well, I will say I have many words, so I want to try to keep it concise. But I, for the first time, I will say in 8 years, I feel relieved. I feel exactly the contrary to fearful. I feel at peace. I feel like our country was definitely going in the wrong direction from a global perspective as well as internally.
What gives you relief globally, Jenny? What gives you a feeling of relief?
So I see coming out of this, and of course I'm on social media, and I actually live in a Hispanic area as well. There's a lot of fear regarding racism, you know, just internally in the United States. You see it coming out in the media, you see it coming out in social media. In terms of the world, I feel that from an ISIS standpoint has been something I'm concerned highly about, in terrorism, not just in the United States, but, you know.
Why does Donald Trump's election make you feel relieved, Jenny?
Because I feel that we have not invested in the military. We've actually pulled the military back, and we need to reinvest and align with our generals in the United States. I do feel like Pence, I feel like Corker, I feel like some of the team that may be surrounding President Trump will be very beneficial in rebuilding our military.
Does that mean you want the U.S. to be more assertive, more aggressive militarily?
Yes, more assertive, not necessarily aggressive. When he said, you know, I forget the quote, nuke them, or I think it was extreme. I think he has to do a better job of pulling back the rhetoric and clarifying what he's trying to say. I do understand how he incites fear. That does concern me when I see the reaction to the election. But from an American, a professional woman, a single mom, I will say, I feel that immigration is another area. When build a wall, heck yes, build the proverbial wall, reform immigration. It's not to say deport people that are legal citizens. Our country's been based on people coming in through our, I mean, my parents were immigrants. So, I mean, our country's founded, our greatness is founded on immigration. But let's reform it and not bring illegal immigrants as we brought in.
Jenny, we've got it. If you'll permit me, let me take it to Ambassador John Herbst. Ambassador Herbst, you're part of this group that warned before the vote against the election of Donald Trump because, you know, it would be bad for America's standing in the world. Square that with this American voter in Iowa who says she feels relieved by the election of Donald Trump. She sees a kind of an assertion of strength there that makes her feel calmer for the first time in a while, she says.
I understand what she's saying partly because I think it's safe to say that President Obama does not understand hard power politics. And while I am not a fan of what Donald Trump has said on the campaign trail on foreign policy, I think he may well understand hard power politics. And it's very important that the President of the United States understand that. So there I'm with her. I think, though, that she may be being a little bit naive about President-elect Trump's inclinations. Because, in fact, his inclinations are largely to pull back, not to step forward, although with the one possible dangerous exception, where it would not be wise, of Iran.
Go to the Middle East and how a Trump policy then might be different from an Obama policy. Hard power in the Middle East? You think just by threatening it or arming up some more, you can change the dynamic there?
I think the following, which is not quite answering your question directly. The United States has had periods in the past, certainly up through the end of the administration of Bush the Elder, who was an excellent foreign policy president, where we have projected a position of military and political strength in the Middle East, which enabled us, at least in the days before the Iranian Revolution, to have good relations with both the Shah of Iran and Saudi Arabia. Today, the Middle East is riven by the conflict between those two countries, and by the perception, which is not an incorrect perception, that Obama has stepped back with the use of American military force, the sense that he doesn't quite understand how to use it. And that is a dangerous thing. And
he said explicitly he doesn't want to use it, doesn't want to go back down that Iraq war road that costs so much.
This is all very complicated. I am with Obama when he says he does not want to repeat the mistakes of the Iraq war, although he did something similar, although not as large a mistake, in Libya. But that was sort of against type. So he's right to want to stay away from those things. But there's something problematic when the President of the United States lays down a red line in Syria. The red line is crossed and the United States does not act. There's something problematic when Russia is bombing American allies in Syria and the United States does not respond. Those are serious, you might say, mistakes of omission, in other words, failure to act, which suggests that he does not understand power and the United States does not strongly back its friends in the region.
Zinya Wickett, you served on the National Security Council. Do you see in a Trump administration this kind of finesse? I mean, you go back to H.W. Bush, and he did get pretty strong kudos for the way he balanced things in the Gulf War period. Do you see that kind of finesse surrounding Donald Trump?
I think John is making some very good points here. The diplomacy, foreign affairs, is all about the nuance. It's all about having a good understanding of the tools in your toolbox and using them deftly. Sometimes it's about deterrence. It's about using hard power to deter others from taking action. Sometimes it's about, you know, the soft outstretched hand, as Obama put out to the Iranians right at the beginning of his first term, the hand of diplomacy, if you will. So that nuance is extraordinarily important in foreign policy because, as Ambassador Herbst points out, these are really complex problems with huge repercussions. So, you know, you let Russia take territory, Crimea, with no consequence, and you absolutely know that other countries, for example, China, is watching that and is calculating what they can do without consequence. So the nuance and having the full toolbox is extraordinarily important, particularly when you're the only country with that robust and that broad of a toolbox. President Obama hasn't used the full toolbox terribly effectively. The fear is that President Trump would also not use the full toolbox at America's hands effectively. And I think that's where, as Ambassador Herbst discussed, that's where his team is extraordinarily important. So does he bring in a cabinet who have experience of the nuances, have experience of engaging in diplomacy, in foreign policy more broadly? And the answer is he does have some people around him who have done this before. And you have to remember, he has not governed anything. He's run companies. Yeah. He's an effective CEO, but he has never governed an institution
like
the government.
But like who then? Newt Gingrich for Secretary of State? Is that what you're talking about?
So Newt Gingrich, you may not approve of his policies, you may not approve of him as an individual, but he has huge experience in governing. So does John Bolton. Again, you may not agree with his sentiments, but he has huge experience of governing.
Very neocon, go to war.
Very neocon. You also have to accept the fact that not only is it cabinet who's going to be extraordinarily important, they will be working through American institutions, and I have huge faith in American institutions. So they will be working with the bureaucracy that is the State Department, the bureaucracy, the civil service, the military, at the Defense Department. He will be working with the Department of Energy and the Department of Commerce and the Treasury.
But doesn't
and the
Trump
NSC,
have the sort of CEO instincts on the campaign trail? He was very much a go-it-alone guy. Even with his inner circle, had a difficult time even taking his Twitter away from him.
Absolutely, but the same respect, President Obama tried in the beginning of his first term to do everything. He tried to keep all policy in the White House. That was very much an intellectual, I have to be involved in everything. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work. America is too large, is involved in too many things, and you need to devolve responsibility. Donald Trump will know that you need to devolve responsibility. You as an individual alone can't do everything. So he's going to make choices, and he is going to have to rely on the arms of the U.S. government to implement those choices. And so, again, I come back to this idea that as the international community and many Americans look at the Trump election with trepidation, with fear, you have to recognize he's not governing alone. He has a team around him, and he has to use the instruments of American foreign and domestic policy to implement, to practice what his preferred objectives are, to achieve his objectives. That means Congress as well, by the way. And even though there is a Republican House and Senate, the Republican Party is not a unitary party anymore. It has, at a minimum, three factions, the Trump faction, the Freedom Caucus, and, of course, the traditional Republicans. So I shouldn't expect things to go smoothly in Congress either over the longer term.
Watch for the team, including the sort of deep in place team, I guess deeper in place. Nathan in Oklahoma City. Thank you for calling, Nathan. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that there's a lot of talk about Trump's racist remarks and racism, and I understand because that's a hot button term and that's fun on the news. But I really want to kind of let everyone understand that what this is really about and why Trump got elected, I believe, is a matter of sovereignty. It's a matter of national pride, patriotism, in the same sense that Brexit, the European Union, you had Germany and England were the really two strong economic powers in Europe, and every time there was a bill to be paid, it fell on them. And every time there was excess jobs being needed, it fell on on England, I'm sorry. And after a while, especially the working class, when their own country is imploding and all their money is going to this broader picture and this globalist plan, you start feeling like, at what point are you not England anymore, but you're just the cash cow for the EU? And I think the same thing happened with America, and we were the NATO and the UN, we just feel like we are the world security force and the world bank, and every time there's something to be paid or done, troops to be sent overseas, it's America who has to make the sacrifice. And when our own country, we saw our roads and bridges imploding within and our own infrastructure lagging behind countries like Europe, we start feeling like, what are we all working for? And I think it's just a movement to pull things in, get back to patriotism, get back to national sovereignty, and to be honest, be a little bit more selfish.
Nathan, I appreciate your call. Yishwar Prasad, how do you respond to that? I don't know if we can take race entirely out of that, perhaps. Sovereignty and patriotism can bleed that way. But this bigger picture, the U.S. has been seen as a cash cow by a lot of voters, being milked by the world. And now, does that work as a way of looking at the world, which may not like globalism, but the world is relatively globalized?
So I think the caller very eloquently stated the concerns that obviously a lot of American people seem to have, and they've voiced their view on this, that the U.S. isn't the power that it once was, and more importantly, the forces of globalization, you know, rising trade, rising financial flows and so on, haven't worked for the majority of Americans, and they feel excluded. They feel that the political and economic elite have created these problems that are affecting the common person, and they have no interest in solving them. So again, at some level, it was a cry of frustration. Now, I was in Beijing actually last week, Tom, and mm-hmm. as you can imagine, the U.S. elections were topic number one. I wanted to talk about the Chinese economy. They wanted to talk about the U.S. elections. And there was a very strong sense in Beijing that while the short run could be somewhat dicey for the bilateral relationship, I heard the sentiment being expressed repeatedly that he is a businessman and he will know what needs to be done. Now, at some level, this could be a roll of the dice because, you know, things could get better. Certainly, they can't get much worse in Washington, one might feel. But to me, Tom, I think this is really going to be a true test of the strength of American institutions. Many of us, Zini alluded to this, I have written about this, that we've talked about the institutionalized system of checks and balances that keep the power of any branch of the U.S. government in check. Right now, Donald Trump is going to be in the White House. The Republicans have control of Congress, so they could do a lot that could be constructive. They could do things that are less constructive, both in the short run and the long run. But the real question about whether the checks and balances come into play is, I think, something we're going to see, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
Can the U.S. pull back and win at the same time in the world as it is now, Ishwar?
That's going to be a little difficult. Certainly, the U.S. can win in the short run if it fends off trade from the rest of the world. In the short run, this may help some American firms. But ultimately, this is, in my view, not the right way to establish a dominant presence in the world. The U.S. has to lead, and it has led so far by propagating the values of democracy, free enterprise, freer trade, and so on. And the U.S., in my view, could be leading better by thinking about how to make globalization work much better rather than retreating from it. I think this could end up validating some of the views of leaders in China who view unfettered free enterprise, the democratic system of government, free speech, freedom of expression as antithetical to running an economy efficiently. And my fear is that the sense of isolationism and protectionism that could come out of this election season and in the next administration could perhaps buffer the U.S. a little bit in the short term, but could have very significant consequences in the long run in terms of U.S. power.
We're going to leave it right there for today. The whole world waiting. The U.S. looking out now with a new president-elect, Ishwar Prasad at Cornell, author of Gaining Currency. Thank you very much for being with us today, Ishwar.
Thank you, Tom. That was a pleasure.
Ambassador John Herbst at the Atlantic Council in Washington, the Eurasia Center there. Ambassador Herbst, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Zenia, are you heartened or otherwise today?
I think that we're having exactly the right conversation. We need to understand not just what's said, what the rhetoric is, but what this means, and we very much need to look forward. So thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you from Chatham House. Zenia Wickett there with us from London. Listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll all be watching. This is On Point.